This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Lake County's drainage crews have been out working here as the weather has improved. And of course, now taking a break for the winter months. But they have done a lot of work when the weather was nice here in Lake County. In particular, clearing away tons of fallen trees and debris from county ditches that otherwise, had they not been cleaned out, would have been some big flooding problems. With us to talk about it, and of course, the latest as far as how much Lake County taxpayers are saving because of all this work, we have Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson. Bill, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure to be on, and I'm a fan of the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Tell people, if you will, for those who are not familiar, within the surveyor's office, you get to keep track of all of the ditches in Lake County, and they're all over the county, come to think of it, especially if they're located outside the cities and towns.
Sure, absolutely. So, as a surveyor, as a Lake County surveyor, I'm the technical advisor for the Lake County Drainage Board, which are the three commissioners, the three county commissioners, and we have over 600 miles of what are called county-regulated drains. So those are open ditches, tiled farm tiles, old sewer pipes and things like that that we maintain. There are a lot of them in municipalities and also in the unincorporated areas as well.
We know that most people see the ditches around, especially if you live or travel through North Lake County a lot, and even as far south, I guess, in sections of North Lake County is the town of Griffith and other places in Highland. The ditches are there. You see a lot of times what condition they're in as well, too. How long does it take, on average, to get on the big list to make sure that somebody knows at the surveyor's office that a particular ditch or ditches need to be maintained?
Well, that's a good question. So it kind of depends on the waterway itself. So we have to consider a lot of things. One of them being, for example, on Katie Marsh Ditch, it runs through Highland, Griffith, and then Cal Township. And it's a very flat area, so it collects a lot of sediment. The water doesn't always move as well as we'd like it to. So we do have to maintain that a little more often than other ditches, so we generally get to that every about 10 years or so is what we've been trying to do, or a little sooner.
Mm-hmm. The idea, I guess, to have the ditches, of course, is to allow agricultural areas to be more useful. Otherwise, they'd probably be flooded all the time. And also, too, I guess you have a lot of wetland area. Maybe people don't realize that, or maybe it seems that most of the wetland that is around in Lake County is all south of, say, U.S. 30.
Yeah, that's where a lot of it historically was, and especially around the Kankakee River in the far south portion of the county. Probably the south quarter of the county used to be all a marsh, a wetland, which was drained in the early 1900s to create some really good farmland that we have now. But that land kind of always wants to return to that state, so it's kind of a constant battle, making sure that we maintain these waterways. And also, like I said, the Katie Marsh Ditch area and other areas in North Lake County were historically wetlands that were drained and then developed. So it's kind of a constant maintenance of these waterways that we have to do to make sure that people don't flood.
That's probably the most important thing. We note here it's because of all of this development going from agricultural land to being developed in one way or the other, and it even comes down to, I guess, when you have big parking lots, you have additional problems that make it more difficult to get the ditches to drain properly.
That's a really good point. So with the unincorporated areas, which we control the development in, and almost, I think, well, every municipality has ordinances that are very similar that require new developments to detain that water that runs off the buildings and the impervious areas so that it releases at a slower rate and doesn't harm anybody downstream.
What would you say as far as the areas that either are flood prone the most or do actually flood the most are ones that you and your crews at the surveyor's office have to keep the closest eye on the ditches to make sure that they are flowing as they should?
We see a lot of issues down by the Kankakee River in our jurisdiction that just historically it's been a lot of issues down there. So we spend a lot of time in that area. We're also working right now with the state of Indiana and all the eight counties that border or that the Kankakee River goes through. We're working with those counties to come up with a plan for better maintenance and kind of management of the river. And the state's been great to work with on that, and we've been working on that through the KRBC. We also see a lot of issues on Heart Ditch in Dyer, in Munster, and we're working with the Little Calumet River Basin and the towns of Highland and Munster and Dyer to address some of those issues right now as well.
Now, I know that your department has basically four people that work with you full-time on keeping these ditches well-maintained, and you probably have to hire some extra help in the summer months, too, to get more work done, don't you?
Yeah, we do. So all winter we see obstruction, so we've been trying to keep a kind of a skeleton crew on the drainage crew throughout the winter to address these issues. But the summer months when we see a lot of the rain and a lot of the trees fall in that we need to get taken out, we do have four-member crews that work throughout the summer independently and sometimes together, depending on if it's a really big job. But on the smaller jobs, we can sometimes split them up to make them even more efficient.
What do the crews typically do when they go in? I'm sure they have a list if they haven't checked it out themselves. You've kept them posted on what has to be done in a particular area. What do they have to do when they go in to do some maintenance work, to some cleanup work, I guess?
Yeah, so basically it all starts with me and my drainage administrator. We actually reached out to Jerome Prince this year. He has a really cool program through a company called Nearmap that does aerial photography a little more frequently than we have in the past because it's getting more cost-effective to do that. And so we look at that kind of more current aerial photography. I think the last one we have is from late September to find these obstructions in remote areas that are really hard to get to sometimes to inspect physically. So we find these obstructions and then we drop the coordinates to our crew, and that they go out. First thing is to make sure that it's safe to do by hand, and we don't need to hire a contractor with a machine to do it. And if they can do it, then they go in actually by hand and waders, and a lot of times they fall in, but that's part of the job too.
It's probably an occupational hazard, you know, especially if you're in the water. Yeah.
Yeah, which is not bad in the hot summer months. Sometimes they enjoy it. So, and so they go in with the chainsaws by hand, and usually with ropes, rip out the obstruction and put it in a place where it won't wash back in. And then they also have a winch on one of the trucks that they can use if the obstruction's too big.
Now you talked about having contractors that help you out if it gets too big. What equipment do they bring in to be able to help clear things out if you need them?
Yeah, so we generally just an excavator, a regular excavator. We do have one contractor that we're in touch with who has actually a floating machine excavator that can get into areas that some can't. But that again, that gets very expensive to do just to mobilize that machinery and have contractors come out. So and that's kind of the prices that we use to compare what we spent on our seasonal drainage crew versus what that would have cost. And we've come up with $433,000, $433,632 of savings as of October 25th.
I'm sure the Lake County Commissioners probably appreciate that work that they'll be able to do with their own people as opposed to having to hire additional crews.
Oh, they absolutely do, and I think the council is really happy about it too, because we're always looking for ways to save money.
Well, since the county council is one that keeps the purse string, so to speak, and they keep you and other department heads in the county government in line to make sure you toe the line on the budget, they probably are hoping that you'll find any cost-effective way to do so. Now that you've gotten one season of cleanup here lately out of the way, what can you plan for work in 2019?
Well, I think it's going to be more of the same. These obstructions are kind of constantly happening, especially, you know, with the wind that we have, for example, the last couple of days, there's going to be a lot of trees down and obstructions in our waterways. So it's a constant battle, really. And we constantly have beavers working, creating beaver dams that can really impact properties and property values. So we're constantly working on it.
Now, obviously, you're focusing in, of course, on the drainage ditches, mainly in South Lake County, but in the areas that are unincorporated outside of the cities and the towns. You mentioned Calumet Township in particular, for one ditch there, the Katie Marsh ditch. What help do you get, or at least guidance from the cities and towns, from their governments, to let you know about problems that maybe they may be able to handle themselves, but they probably ask for a helping hand?
Oh, they do, and we have really good relationships, too, with the municipalities. And actually, one of the really great things they do is a lot of times if we're in a municipality, especially like a more developed area, say in Highland there, on the Katy Marsh ditch. We'll remove obstructions, and they'll come and either chip it for us or haul away the debris. So it's a really good working relationship that we have.
Now, you mentioned about the fact that you get to work closely with not only the municipalities, but also you mentioned the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission, and the fact that we've had conversations with Dan Repay before about the work that they do. They have, of course, a big list that they try to take care of whenever the weather breaks in the spring to be able to do cleanup along the levee system and the river that they're concerned about. What kind of help can they offer you, or do they offer you on a regular basis to help take care of these problems?
Yeah, we work really well with the Little Calumet River Basin Commission as well. Dan Repay, you know, him and I are texting, you know, during rain events, trying to coordinate either response efforts or things like that. And we also have done some joint projects with them, and they've funded us on some of our projects. So it's really good relationship. And like I said, we're working with Dan and his board on the Hart Ditch north of Main Street, which is not currently a county regulated drain, but it has some pretty significant bank erosion issues and things like that. So we're kind of in talks right now with them and the town of Munster and Highland to try to address some of those issues that have been around for a long time.
When you go even further to the east, in places like over in the area around Gary and points to the east in Hobart and the like, you probably have to do more work in some of those open areas. I imagine that would require some special attention.
Yeah, you know, absolutely, and it's all related. It's all connected. You know, water doesn't know the boundary between Hobart and Lake Station or anything else. So it's something that we all really have been working on together.
You mentioned about the cooperation that you have from the municipalities and from the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission. When it is time to have to deal with flooding problems or potential flooding problems, what can you do to be ahead of the game, so to speak, to be able to help keep the obstructions down more than you are? When it starts to rain, you're busy, like you say, you're texting with Dan Repay to find out what the situation may be in his particular neck of the woods, so to speak. But what can you do and get your crews on the surveyor's office do to help keep the drainage ditches even cleaner, even though you do the regular maintenance?
I think we're doing everything we can right now. I mean, we're trying to, again, keep the communication lines open. Quite honestly, I'm very lucky to have the council and commissioners that I have to have the budget that we have. We have a $2.1 million budget next year to do a lot of these improvements that really, really need to be done. And I think the citizens want that to be done. They want these infrastructure improvements, and I think all the elected officials, at least in Lake County, are on board with that.
Well, we've been talking with Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson about the cleanup that his drainage crews do every year in the warm weather months to help clear away the obstructions and the debris that collects in the drainage ditches, in particular in the unincorporated areas of Lake County and points in South Lake County in particular, helping the farmers and helping the developers and everyone in general to have flat lands that are draining properly and they're not backing up as much as possible. And Bill, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about what you and your crews are doing, and that you've had a rather successful 2018 and the best that you're able to continue in keeping the drainage ditch system cleaned out in 2019. Thanks for talking with us today about it.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I depend on myself. And I take care of myself, and I took care of my girls, and I've taught my girls to take care of themselves, and they know that. Not just to rely on someone else. I had relied on someone else for my happiness until my divorce. I am bipolar. I have a brother who's bipolar. I have a great uncle who's bipolar. It does run in the family. My mother also had issues. There was a point where I was working and taking care of my children, and it got to be too much. I needed more help than I had, and I had a nervous breakdown. So I was in the hospital, so my mother-in-law was watching the girls. And my mother-in-law, my ex-husband, took advantage of that. My mother-in-law took the girls across state lines and kept them in a hotel for 2 weeks. So I called the police. And the police were not willing to help because here's this crazy woman in a hospital, and so the father has the kids. What's wrong with that? The police in Michigan said that it was a custody issue and they don't get involved. My kids spent 9 years away from me. I tried to go back to work, but I was so preoccupied with my loss. It was as if my children died. I just wanted to die. I just wanted to die. And I couldn't focus on work. All I could focus on was my loss and my children. I just couldn't work at the time. My boss was great. They put in for my all my vacation pay, you know, my sick leave time, all of that they put in for. They were very nice. They were very understanding, told me I could have my job back when I was ready. I just never got ready. I never actually truly recovered from losing my kids. It was difficult. I did not want to stay with family because they weren't understanding what I was going through. I was living in LaPorte at the time, and the township was absolutely fantastic. They paid for my rent for 3 months. And before that, I still had money coming in for my job from my PTO time, and I scrimped and I saved, and I was able to stay in my apartment for about 5 months. But then I just couldn't anymore. So I didn't have my kids. I didn't have my job. I didn't have my possessions, and I was in a car and not wanting to ask for any help whatsoever. But finally, I had to stay at my parents' house, and my parents were trying to take the discipline type of road with me because I was acting out. They didn't understand mental illness at the time. So I slept on the couch, and I had a laundry basket with just my possessions. That was it. And I did that for an entire year, which is very difficult because I was in a household that didn't understand what was going on with me. And then housing opportunities saved my life. They were fantastic, but I was on a waiting list for about a year. But they were wonderful. They talked to me. They were compassionate. They were helpful. It's sad that I had to wait a year, but they actually checked on me also to see, you know, how my situation was going and everything. I mean, I can't imagine what would have happened. I don't know where I would be and what I would be doing if I would have to be on my parents' couch. I don't know. I don't know that I would get well as fast or as well as I could get. I'm as well as I can be. I've been down, believe me. I've been suicidal. I've lost my kids. I've lost my possessions. But you know what? I still have my kids. I love them. They're a part of my life. And I'm okay.
You can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we have with us in studio one of the new members of Northwest Indiana's legislative delegation. Chris Jung is a Democrat, and he is going to the State House for his first time in January when the next session begins as representative of District 15, which is, of course, here in Northwest Indiana, in Lake County in particular. And, Chris, thank you for joining us in the studio today here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, I guess the question comes down to since you won the election by defeating incumbent Hal Slaker by 82 votes in the final tally, I guess the question is maybe the should say we were marking before our conversation, the question, the answer to the question, what happened, maybe is a question I'm sure that Hal Slaker and his campaign team was asking more than you. But what do you think happened that put you over the top on election night?
Yeah, well, you know, I get too much credit for the victory, honestly. It was a team effort, for sure. We had a lot of great volunteers who I brought out of retirement, a lot of great volunteers who were in high school and college and who put their studies on hold for me. We had a big team that was going out and just talking to their neighbors, listening to them in particular, what they cared about, and letting them know that an election was coming up because so many many people don't vote in midterms. And we were very proud of the fact that we got a turnout of about 25,000 voters for this midterm, whereas in the last midterm, there were maybe around 14,000 votes cast. So we did get a lot of active new people engaged in the political process. And I think that just ended up putting us over the edge by that 82-vote margin.
Go back, if you will, in the campaign and talk about the issues that you pressed in talking with people, the issues you brought up to them that basically they decided when they went to the ballot box to decide to choose you as the state representative. What were these issues that you now have that you can take with you to Indianapolis?
I think a lot of people were looking for something new to represent them. They were looking for a fresh voice, someone who had fresh ideas and who was able to listen to both sides of the aisle, honestly. We've got a lot of people who are concerned about the direction in terms of the number of young people who are leaving my district and leaving Northwest Indiana and going to the coasts or going to the big cities. We want to be able to capitalize on that, take advantage of the assets that we have in Northwest Indiana, our lakefront and our infrastructure and our transportation and our the size of our population and all these great things, and be able to attract those young people like myself back. And I think what we did so successfully was that so many voting age adults saw in myself their own kid, honestly. They saw, you know, a lot of their kids have left the region, went to school away, and maybe haven't come back to buy homes or raise families or start businesses. And that's what we've been saying from the very beginning, that those are the things that we want to focus on: attracting young people back, economic development, healthcare, and education.
Have you determined, although maybe not on a scientific basis, but you've determined by talking to enough people, the average age, say, of a voter in District 15, are they older voters typically, and do they in turn, can they identify more with you or with, perhaps you should say, their family members that have left town?
Yeah, so population-wise, in terms of the statistics, my district, District 15, which encompasses Tri-Town as well as portions of Griffith, is on average older than the Indiana population as a whole. We have more elderly and fewer young people than the rest of Indiana. So we saw that in a lot of the voters that were concerned about the brain drain and concerned about the fact that we have a rapidly aging population that needs to be taken care of as well.
And we refer to Tri-Town for folks that may not be familiar with that. How do you define Tri-Town?
Yes, it's Dyer, Schererville, St. John, and then unincorporated St. John Township as well.
Now, you mentioned about the issues that you felt that maybe the younger residents that grew up in the region but left the region for whatever reason it may be, that may or may not want to come back. You're offering them an opportunity that maybe if things go well at the State House, that you have something to help bring them back to the region, back home?
Yes, absolutely. We're looking at ways to bolster the skilled trades, for instance, and bridge the workforce development gap that we know is such a big problem on both sides of the aisle. Legislators know that this is a big problem in the state of Indiana. We have over 85,000 unfilled jobs in the skilled trades. We can't get kids my age who can pass a drug test, who are getting the education that they need in the school system, who are getting skilled up for the workforce of tomorrow. And in fact, this morning I was just at the Construction Advancement Foundation's annual Skilled Trades Day at the fairgrounds. Mm-hmm. And you've got over 1,300 kids going into the industrial building at the fairgrounds to do hands-on projects, whether it's bricklaying or electrical work or iron workers or teamsters or plumbing. All of these great, high-paying, high-wage jobs that are going to be very much so in need in the future, as well as the fact that they can't be outsourced, which is so important for our global economy and to bolster Indiana's standing in that space. So we can hope that we will definitely put a focus there to attract people into those career fields and to make this a great livable place.
Do you get the impression by talking to people, and certainly we probably got that by going to this event at the fairgrounds, that the opportunities are starting to come back to Northwest Indiana from the time that we've had this mass exodus that kind of started years ago when the steel mills shifted around?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are seeing, thankfully, we've had a good macroeconomic factors that are helping our economy grow in Indiana. We know that we're in a position position of strength relative to our neighbors in Illinois in terms of our budget. And we also want to make sure that we're investing in the people and making sure that they have the opportunities they deserve to get ahead. And so many of the trades, the journeyman trade, skilled tradesmen that I've talked to at the event today were talking about how they have more applicants than apprenticeships available for them. So it's a good problem to have while the economy is booming, for sure. And we want to sustain that as much as possible.
Are there any other issues that you brought up during the campaign that you are hoping that you can take to Indianapolis to talk with your new colleagues now there at the General Assembly?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, healthcare and education are the two big ones that a lot of people are concerned about. Our public school funding, I think, needs to be reviewed and make sure that not only do we have the accountability to make sure that our tax dollars are going towards the classrooms and are staying in the classrooms, but making sure that certain schools that get failing grades from the Department of Education aren't as entitled to that money. And we saw such an imbalance in the funding formula, particularly with the virtual schools, the online schools on average getting more money per student than Lake Central schools, which was really shocking to a huge portion of my district. This is something that was publicized when the referendum before May was being shopped around, and people were understandably pretty angry about that fact, and they felt like their money wasn't being taken care of. So not only are we going to look at that, but we're going to look at bringing down prescription costs for people. I know the cost of insulin is rising so crazily that a lot of people are feeling really pinched by the high cost of medical care in this country.
We're talking with Chris Cheung, who is the new state representative in District House District 15, which here is in Lake County. He unseated veteran incumbent Hal Slager in the November election. Well, you had a chance to join your new colleagues in Indianapolis not long ago for Organization Day, which all lawmakers attend in Indianapolis at the State House as they get ready to open another session in January. What's your impression of the State House? If you haven't been down there before, did you happen to find yourself a bit overwhelmed by not only the size of the building, but how busy the place can be when you get everybody together in one place?
Yeah, it's a fantastic building. I would encourage everyone to take time to visit the seat of their state government in Indianapolis because it's a beautiful facility with a lot of history and a lot of gravitas there. You can feel the weight of the important decisions that are being made in the state capitol. And I was honestly very heartened to meet a lot of my fellow legislators across the aisle on both sides and understand how much common ground we had with being able to run the state of Indiana. I think so much of the big media coverage, the national media coverage, focuses on how we divide ourselves into camps with the partisan divide, the rural and urban divide, and so on and so forth. But honestly, we see eye to eye on so many issues, I think, as Republicans and Democrats. And I think that's what American politics and our institutions really need right now.
Do you find that since you had a chance to meet with your new colleagues here from Northwest Indiana, that you've had a chance to meet them if you hadn't done so already? You think that there's going to be a kinship, or certainly a new kinship, with the new members that are added to be able to make sure that representatives, that people in Northwest Indiana in particular, are well represented?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are definitely focused on making sure Northwest Indiana has a seat at the table. All of us from the Northwest Indiana delegation, regardless of party, again, are focused on working across the aisle and making sure we get business done for Hoosiers, honestly. We're not looking to super partisan or not looking to be obstructionist. We're looking to make sure that we look out for our district's best interests and that we find out a way to work with the other branches of government.
Now that you've had a chance to go down for Organization Day and kind of gotten that experience under your belt, so to speak, I guess we'll talk about the housekeeping issues. I brought these up with the new state representative, Lisa Beck, here not long ago in our conversation. You have to figure out the nuts and bolts of going down to Indianapolis and finding a place to stay for, well, I guess in this case, will be almost 3 months when this coming session begins. It's the longer session because you have a new two-year state budget to work on. First, concerning about this budget, what are your thoughts about what the state of Indiana is going to need to do to be able to keep the operations going and still be able to pay for everything?
Absolutely. The Department of Child Services is one of those top priority items that we saw a lot of media coverage about in the last 2 years or so. We saw with the high-profile departure of Dr. Mary Beth Bonaventura and the issues at DCS remain with the funding gap there, the fact that we foster kids at twice the rate of Illinois despite having half the population of Illinois is a huge issue that a lot of people are feeling. As a court-appointed child advocate for Lake County, I saw these issues with a lot of the funding issues and a lot of the ways that the kids were underserved in this population. So funding DCS and making sure that we pay our caseworkers fair wages so that they can take on good work and make sure that they aren't overworked while providing good outcomes for our kids is a top priority for legislators on both sides of the aisle. And like I said, we're going to try to make sure that we make some accountability around the education funding and making sure that we keep it in our schools for sure.
Now, I have to ask, since you made the trip down to Indianapolis, and maybe you've made many of them before, I don't know, but what's your experience in making the travel down I-65 to get to the center of the state, and in particular to the center of Indianapolis itself?
It can be a little busy. I know I-65 can be tough to navigate on, and especially in the winter months, but you know, I'm going to be prepared for it, and thankfully we can lean on the other members of the delegation up here in case we need to carpool.
Also, too, the question always comes up, and many people have planned this out ahead of time, not only new members, but even veteran members of the legislature have to plan that they'll have to stay in Indianapolis for a few days and during the week and then make it back home to their districts to talk with constituents and take care of family affairs that you have to deal with. Have you made the plans, or are you in the process of making the plans to be able to stay down in Indy if you have to?
Yeah, I'm in the process of looking for a place. I'm looking at some short-term small apartments and couch surfing a little bit, too, so.
Did you find in traveling down to Indianapolis and not only getting accustomed to the traffic flow going into the city, but driving around the city itself, that this kind of adds to the excitement of being a new member of the legislature, that after a while it's going to be very tiring and probably very upsetting, I would imagine, but there's a certain amount of excitement, do you feel, that you face along with the prospects of what you'll be doing when the General Assembly session starts?
Absolutely. I feel the honor and the blessing that I have in this position to represent 65,000 people in my district, and it just wows me every day when I walk into the State House or when I take calls from constituents or meetings with different interest groups. It is just such an honor to be able to represent them and to be able to fight for them and be their voice for the next 2 years. So we're hoping we can sustain that for sure.
What have you mentioned to people back here in the district after the election's over with? Are you finding when you talk with folks at the supermarket, at the shopping center, wherever you happen to be, if they know of you or recognize you, what they have to say?
Yeah, it's funny because we got so much press coverage and after the election because it was so narrow and because there was some drama around a potential recount that ended up not happening. And it just kind of, and my face was in the paper more so than I liked for it to be. But I was very pleased to learn that a lot of people were just excited about someone who looked a lot different from what they typically have on their ballot representing them. So I hope I can do a good job.
Do you feel that you'll have this advantage because you show the diversity in Northwest Indiana to maybe some areas of the state that don't always have that much diversity?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really proud of the fact that I didn't even honestly think about it after I got in, but I believe I'm the first Asian American legislator, and I'm one of the youngest ones that have been elected. So I'm really pleased by that fact, and I hope we can encourage Asian Americans and the millennials from both sides of the aisle to just get up and run for office and serve their communities.
Well, Chris Jung, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the experiences that you had not only here in the region going through the election, but a little ahead of what you're going to face as being a new member of the General Assembly starting in January. Thank you for sharing that with us today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking. Let's check in and see what the latest coming up on the agenda for repairs and or improvements to the Little Calumet River system of levees. And let's turn now to Dan Repe. He's Executive Director of the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission. And Dan, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
What's on the agenda, so to speak, for any improvement projects in the Little Calumet area for the rest of this year going into 2019?
Sure. In the future, we have two probably major projects, and that number one would be raising the level of Kennedy Avenue Bridge as it crosses over the Little Kamet River. Currently, when we're under high water situations, we have to close it down, which affects traffic, which affects, you know, people's work lives, social lives, and a whole lot of other things. So the project right now is going to be constructed as it is scheduled for a start of 2019. And it's going to be a two-year project because we don't want to completely shut down the all traffic flow. So that will be a project that you'll see in 2019. We also have, we're going to design a levee that is been probably long needed for the folks of Lake Station in the neighborhood of 29th in Wyoming. They've been affected by high water and flooding for many years, and we finally have acquired enough property to start the design work on that. That construction will be actually 2020, unfortunately, but that's just what needs to take place. That will protect approximately 400 to 500 homes that normally get inundated with water during high water events, and now that will not only protect them, but we hope that with that will advance people investing in those communities, building new homes, which adds assessed value, which helps economic development in Lake Station. And then another project that we're working on through the winter now that will should be complete by May of 19 is a railroad bridge just to the north of Old Ridge Road and the environmental area there in Hobart and by George Lake. That railroad improvement will increase the capacity which water can pass through. Previous times, water coming from Deep River, Duck Creek was sort of being just held up to a point where it was causing some backflow. This project will increase it by fivefold to allow water to go downstream at a quicker rate, which we believe all of our models have told us so that it can handle it without putting any negative impact on any folks or residents downstream, which is we don't want to get rid of one problem to create one further downstream. So those are three probably the major projects. We still have some other projects that are going on in the different communities that are a little bit smaller, but those are the three major ones that we're really focusing on.
Are you finding that there's any major problems that going even further east here, going into Portage, going into Porter County, that the projects that you have to work in cooperation with the Porter County officials on?
Yeah, and we've had discussions with Porter County officials. Just as I mentioned prior, we don't want to, you know, stop a problem and then just to create one downstream. Conversely, we have to make sure that when the water runs through Porter County, out by the Portage Marina, that it's a clear shot that there is no blockages, because it doesn't do anybody any good for the Burns Ditch to be blocked. So we've been working with them. We believe we may come up with some sort of maintenance plan to help make sure any fallen trees are cleared out of that area so that water can flow freely, not only for flood control, but for recreational purposes as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a lot of projects here, a lot of things that are on the table for 2019. When you talk about getting some of this work started, how early in the year can you get going?
Although right now we're experiencing a little bit colder weather than we would like to see. Normally we can get into early December to finish some of this stuff off. But, you know, we try to time the projects out so that we can still do the work. For instance, the railroad project is something that doesn't require, you know, the asphalt or the concrete. It's mainly just structural work, and it's prefabricated. So we'll just have to be able to place it and put it in place, and there's no there's no really time constraints on what we need to do on that. Now, when you talk about the design work, that's all, sort of room work or drafting work. And then certainly when we talk about construction of Kennedy, you know, that's actually something that is weather sensitive. But we anticipate that to begin and award that contract over the winter for them to be ready to go. As everyone from Northwest Indiana knows, there's two seasons. It's winter and it's construction season.
That's
so
right.
As soon as winter is over with, we want them to get moving on that project. So,
and we know for sure that's going to be a very important one. That's going to have the most impact, you say, not only on the residents and the businesses in the area there on Kennedy Avenue, but the motorists that travel through there, since you're talking about a very, very busy spot there just south of 8094 in Hammond as well as in Highland, a lot of travelers, a lot of businesses are going to be affected.
One of the lessons that was learned from 2008, I wasn't here in 2008, but after looking at after-the-fact reports, was the fact that most the difficult aspect was, besides certainly the people devastated by the flooding, was the fact that no one could travel north or south within the area from I-65 to the state line. The traffic was basically shut off. You couldn't get to the steel mills. You couldn't get to the refinery. You couldn't get to the casinos. You couldn't get anywhere north of the expressway because of the fact that all the roads were closed off for temporary purposes to prevent flooding. So by us raising the level, yes, there's going to be some high water issues, but you'll still be able to get over the expressway, which will lend itself to help economic development, but also for safety reasons, too. You have some hospitals that are south of the river that, certainly people would like to get to in the case of emergency, and you don't want to be shut off from too many of them. You only have St. Catharines up there, as we speak of the Hammond Highland area. So, mm-hmm. It's something that we looked at from a public safety standpoint as well, so that we can make sure the traffic is constantly flowing.
Well, some very important projects getting underway in 2019 there on the Little Calumet River Basin area. And as always, thanks to spend some time with us to go over these projects. We're looking forward to getting these projects underway here when the weather breaks in 2019. And thank you very much, Dan, for joining us to tell us about it.
Thank you for having me, and anytime you want an update, I'd be happy to do so.
Well, thank you very much. Dan Repay is the Executive Director of the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission. Got some news from Franciscan Health about a new professional services agreement that involves not only Northwestern Memorial Hospital, but hospitals here in Northwest Indiana as well. And for this, we are turning to the President and CEO of Franciscan Health, Crown Point, Dr. Daniel McCormick. Dr. McCormick, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'll let you make the big announcement here, and it's a very important announcement that involves patients here in Northwest Indiana and some great facilities. Tell us about it.
Well, yes, it's a very impactful announcement. Traditionally, we've cared for patients in Northwest Indiana who have suffered stroke symptoms through our accredited stroke centers at our facilities. Recently, medical literature has shown that we can expand the treatment of patients with stroke and improve their outcomes remarkably up to 24 hours of the onset of symptoms. Those studies came out in the New England Journal of Medicine at the beginning of 2018. Since that time, Northwestern has been taking care of those patients within the 24-hour period. Prior to that, it had really been cut off at about 6 hours. So patients who would suffer a stroke and would not be able to seek care until 6 hours after the onset of symptoms would essentially be relegated to no treatment or modified treatment, would portend a worse prognosis with regards to recovery. As we expand the treatment of symptoms, as we expand the treatment window, then what the study showed is that if you are able to show that there is significant brain tissue that has not suffered irreversible damage, that you can show significant improvement in their recovery. And so with Northwestern's assistance and our collaboration, we are able now to provide care for patients up to 24 hours after the onset of symptoms. And we will be doing that through a telestroke program. The program is set to start at the beginning of 2019 and really will encompass telestroke monitors in our emergency rooms in Hammond, Munster, Dyer, and Crown Point.
Tell us a little more about the telestroke program. We've heard about this in other facilities, in particular with the Northwestern Memorial Hospital System. How is that going to work well here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, the monitors will be in place in all of the emergency rooms, and we'll have protocols in place so when a patient arrives through any of our EMS systems into our emergency rooms, the telestroke monitor would be brought into the patient's room, and within 10 minutes we would receive consultation from Northwestern Department of Neurology. Those Those specialists are trained specifically in stroke and would be readily available to view not only the patient and ask the patient questions and run through physical exam, speak with the physician, but also review all of the radiology that's involved with the diagnosis and treatment of stroke.
When you talk about being able to set up the telestroke services within the facilities in Crown Point and Dyer and Hammond and Munster, you have a lot of possibilities, I guess, for making sure that patients get the treatment that they need almost, not quite immediately, but pretty close to it, because we know that minutes count when it comes to somebody who's suffering from a stroke.
Correct, and that's probably the most significant impact of the program. Time is of the essence in the patient who suffers a stroke. And with being able to expand the window of treatment up to 24 hours, we should be able to impact the outcomes of patients in Northwest Indiana quite significantly. And if, you know, I think the one thing we have to understand, if we don't have the equipment on hand to provide care, we can immediately transfer the patient to Northwestern. With our agreement, we have an understanding that they would already meet the neurologist through the telestroke platform, and they would see them at the receiving end at Northwestern, and that would be facilitated amongst our two facilities in a seamless manner. And so we would get rid of a lot of the stumbling blocks of transferring a patient in an expeditious manner.
Now, if the routine is going through as it should with the changeover for the telestroke program, if need be, having to take somebody to Northwestern Memorial Hospital, how long on average would it take to get a patient from Northwest Indiana right into downtown Chicago?
Well, that's a very good question. A lot of that would depend on the severity of the symptoms and the interventions planned on their end. So the modes of transportation are obviously by land or by air.
Right.
And you could, and so it would depend on which mode that it would take. Obviously, if it were by land, it would take longer depending on the time and the weather. And also, the air transport can be less than a half hour to get to that facility. It also will depend on the weather.
Well, it still sounds like, though, that you can get a patient quickly to a facility if need be. If you can't take care of them here in Northwest Indiana, you can get them into the main hospital in Chicago and get the treatment continuing on right away.
Right, and that's the critical piece. We wanted to take out a lot of the barriers to getting a patient to the appropriate location for the treatment that they need.
Okay. Tell us how long it's taken, I guess, to get all these arrangements made. This is not something that you can do overnight, I would imagine.
That is very true. We have been speaking with Northwestern for the greater part of a year at this time, but there are a lot of pieces you could imagine that we have to get in place to have a program of this, this impactful of a program implemented. We here in Crown Point will be initiating the program and making sure that we have the systems in place, and then we'll roll it out after to Hammond, Munster, Dyer.
Well, it sounds like it's a great program that's gotten underway with the start of the program here involving Franciscan Health and Northwestern Memorial Hospital, partnering on some very important neurological services that will help everybody in Northwest Indiana, certainly in particular those suffering from strokes, to get the help they need right away. And Dr. McCormick, thank you very much for talking about it, and the best of luck, and hope this new arrangement works well and will help as many people as possible.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Dr. Daniel McCormick. He's the president and CEO of Franciscan Health Crown Point. Franciscan Health is now partnering with Northwestern Memorial Hospital and partnering on neurological services that include a very interesting and innovative telestroke program to help patients maybe suffering from strokes. If you're a baby boomer, here's a statistic that should concern you. By 2030, one in five Americans will be 65 or older. Yet a Harvard University study shows that the nation has a serious shortage of the kind of affordable housing that they can grow old in. Side Effect Public Media's Samantha Horton tells us, though, of one solution.
The first beam goes up for a one-bedroom house. It's 640 square feet, about the size of a three-car garage. This type of tiny house is the idea of geriatrician Dr. Bill Thomas. He once worked in nursing homes, but realized there was something else he could do to help the elderly and disabled live independently. He calls it the Minka House, after a Japanese word for modest rural homes.
Minka offers people a chance to maintain independence and autonomy longer.
The Harvard report finds only 1% of U.S. housing has the key design elements for accessibility. Those include zero-step entries, single-floor homes, wide halls and doorways, and lever-style faucets. Important in a country where the number of seniors who have limited movement or another disability is expected to increase dramatically. The compact house is comparable in size and cost to other tiny homes, with the smallest size starting at $75,000. But Thomas says it's anything but the same as the competition.
We looked at tiny houses, and man, some of them are so cute. But they're not really good for older people, because they tend to require a lot of, like, climbing up the bookshelf to get to the loft.
About a year ago, Thomas built the first of his Minka houses in upstate New York for his daughter. She has a rare neurological disorder that leaves her unable to speak or communicate with her hands. After tweaking the design, Thomas and his team opened a factory last summer to craft parts for the homes. The first one from the factory went up in Evansville, Indiana recently. It's on the University of Southern Indiana campus as part of a multi-aging community project. Officials from other communities have come to Evansville to see Thomas's creation. Jeff Finice of the Loveland, Colorado Housing Authority says the tiny homes could help address the housing shortage in northern Colorado.
Right now, we have a lot of support from our local jurisdiction, city council, and the planning department, and they've even changed their code to allow for this.
In fact, Thomas says hundreds of Minka homes have already been ordered, leaving him to consider opening a second factory. Joanne Arts is 66 and is packing up her office after retiring as a librarian at USI. She had hip replacement surgery in the spring and says the Minka house might allow her to stay connected with multiple generations in a community.
I think that in a microcosm, my years of experience and a little bit of wisdom, whatever I've accrued, could be useful to people of a different generation than I am, where in turn they can teach me things.
On the day of the ribbon cutting, Arts explores the one-bedroom home. There are things she likes about the house, including the wide doorways and a bathroom which features a shower without a high step. That would be better for her with her back issues.
I only need a shower. I don't really need a tub because I can no longer get in and out of a tub.
But she's not sold on it being for her and says maybe if it were bigger, with a second bedroom, she would be interested.
Yes, I should be downsizing, but I'm not ready to downsize that much yet. Then I wouldn't want to have to wait until I was to be able to move into a Minka.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Samantha Horton.
And that's Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for joining us and hope you'll be with us tomorrow. We have a conversation coming up with another new state representative going from Northwest Indiana to the State House, State Representative Carolyn Jackson of Hammond.